We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert in for David Inch, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning is Jason Croft. In 1994, Ken Burns' documentary Baseball was introduces to the very origins of the sport, the emergence of some of the game's first stars, the Black Sox scandal, the Great Depression, the Negro Leagues, the dominance of teams like the Yankees, expansion and free agency. Tomorrow night, Burns will pick up where that program left off, discussing issues like the 1994 player strike, the emergence of Latino and Asian players, the 1998 home run race that won back fans, and steroids. Burns and co-producer and co-director at Lynn Novick present The 10th Inning, that airs tomorrow and Wednesday on WILL and many other PBS stations. Joining me today by phone to discuss 10th Inning is Dave McMahon. The filmmaker first worked for Florentine Films as an assistant editor for the PBS film Jazz. He's also worked on Frontline and was a co-producer of Ken Burns' films The War and the National Parks program. He's also a writer and producer of The 10th Inning. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thanks for being on the show. And joining us in the studio is U of I history professor Adrian Burgos, the associate professor of history. He specializes in U.S. Latino history, urban history, immigration history, and race and ethnic studies. He's been involved in a couple of books, Playing America's Game, Baseball Latinos and the Color Line, and he co-authored Shades of Glory, The Negro Leagues and the Story of African-American Baseball. He was a consultant to Ken Burns on Latino baseball history for The 10th Inning.
Thank you for having me there.
Great to have you in. Dave, well, I guess we'll go to you first. When did Ken Burns first decide he needed to do a follow-up to Baseball? When did you become a part of it?
Well, I was sitting at my desk in Florentine's New York City office, and it was the morning of October 28, 2004, and Ken came bounding into the office after a certain baseball team from New England had finally won the World Series, and he said, "We have to update the baseball series." He had said in the initial one that after they lost in 1986 that the Red Sox would never win the World Series, and so it was time to correct that statement. But I think that as we got into it, we quickly discovered that there was some heftier issues that reflected the American experience as much as any in the first nine innings, and so it would be an undertaking that would be as much about what happened off the field as on the field.
And you certainly had your issues to follow up on. I mean, 94, I don't remember what month baseball aired, but you immediately had something to follow up with a player strike that season.
Yes, well, the initial series aired in September, and it had there was no other baseball on the dial because the strike had commenced in August, and I think at that point Bud Selig had canceled the season, and so they had the dial to themselves. And so we pick up in 1992 in the NLCS, and we're backtracking just a little bit, but it's in that postseason series that we introduced the primary character in the show, Barry Bonds. And then we carry through, and we don't get to the strike until 1994, until about 45 minutes in, but it does set the stage for a kind of depression in terms of interest in the game, and then a revival that takes place, and its most significant moment is probably 1998, where Sosa and McGuire compete for Roger Maris's home run record, which he had held for 37 years before then.
We welcome your calls and questions today about the 10th inning. Again, that will premiere tomorrow night on PBS. I'm Jeff Bossert, filling in as host today. The phone numbers are 333-9455 or outside of the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455. We're talking with Dave McMahon and U of I history professor Adrian Burgos about the 10th inning. Adrian, talk about when you first were involved as a consultant, when you were first brought in.
Well, this is actually an interesting story because I know Dave McMahon for a while. He was one of my undergraduate students at the University of Michigan. And I think Dave actually put it in the ear of both Ken and Lynn Novick that the story of Latinos was something that one of his old TAs at Michigan had worked on. And they read my first book, Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. And one of the criticisms of the first 18 and a half hours of baseball was that the story of Latinos didn't get much attention. And I think we've done a very good job of giving it much clearer attention and the powerful story that is within the baseball of Latinos.
So we pick up with a player strike, really. That's one of the earliest thing we were following in the show. I really felt like having seen the show already, that you chose your interviews well. Can we talk about how you went about? I mean, you said with Boston winning the World Series, picking what themes you would go on, and then who you would talk to, Dave, who you would interview to talk about these things.
Well, we went back to the original series and took from the cast of interviewees that appeared in that one, including Doris Kearns Goodwin, a longtime Red Sox fan. We had to, of course, find out how she responded to this amazing event for all New England baseball fans. And then there were others, George Will, Dan Okrent, Bob Costas, and Tom Boswell, who we returned to. With the original series, I think the experience for Ken and Lynn was that it was an important thing to have the players, but often players address the subject in a kind of player speak that we're all very familiar with, and I think we were trying to get beneath the surface, and so we didn't turn to too many players, but we did work closely with Major League Baseball early on. They sort of gave us the keys to their archive and access to all the footage, and we asked them, who in your experience has a thoughtful perspective on the game, and one of the first people they said was Ichiro Suzuki, and so we approached him, and they also felt that Joe Torre would be a great interview, so we spoke to him as well. And then as we were getting into it and working closely with Adrian and showing him early cuts, he suggested talking to Pedro Martinez, feeling that we lacked a sort of authentic Latin voice who could speak to the experience of coming up from the Dominican Republic, making a go of it, not having full being able to speak English fluently, and taking advantage of that opportunity. And so we pursued him for something like 16 months before finally getting him. And it was maybe one of the most significant things we did in production was to land him. He gives us an incredibly articulate and thoughtful interview and takes us from sitting beneath the mango tree in Managuaba all the way to facing the Yankees in game 7 of the 2003 ALCS and the heartbreak associated with that, and then the triumph that happens the following year.
Yeah. Pedro was really articulate just watching some of the show again last night, and I think this was pointed out when Ken Burns was interviewed recently on All Things Considered, what a great interview Pedro was. But Adrian, you knew full well that Mr. Martinez could do this.
Well, Pedro comes from a baseball lineage. His brother, Ramon Martinez, was also a major league player. Yet Pedro still had to prove himself. And it's a wonderful baseball story unto himself to have this really scrawny-looking pitcher had to prove himself to the baseball world. And then the experience as a Dominican coming out of the baseball-producing part of the world that really part of the late 20th century story of baseball. And Pedro broke my heart multiple times. Yes, the Yankees, you know, persevered in 2003, but he more than enough times. I'm a Yankees fan, and more than enough times, it's just something you have to admire about this guy. 5'11", throws this wickedly hard fastball, the incredible changeup, and who adjusted to being underappreciated from the very start that he could even be a major league player. And as a Dominican, learning to deal with the press. And I was really pleased to see the inclusion of Pedro in the final edit of 10th inning, because Pedro, it can be such a hard interview. And because he fundamentally understands that the press needs him more than he needs the press. He is a star now. He's achieved the greatness of being an international ball player star. And that he was very wonderful in this piece, because he lets you into the world, what it is to be a Dominican, what it is to be a baseball star, and what it is to be a fan too, which is pretty astounding how he talks about rooting for McGuire and rooting for Sosa in that home run chase of 98.
Well, we can go on maybe to talk about that portion of the program. I mean, we see footage of the conditions in some of these cities where some of these up-and-coming Latino stars come from, and And I believe it was the Blue Jays and Dodgers that I think they had the first scouts, but early 80s. And then the program kind of tracks to where we've come from to, you know, since then.
Yes, the Blue Jays and Dodgers were the first ones to set up a camp in Dominican Republic, and you saw players like George Bell and players like Tony Fernandez would be the first fruits of that. And you would also see Ramon Martinez, Pedro Martinez. Unfortunately for the Dodgers, they traded away too many of those up-and-coming Dominican players, but they were the first ones to go down there, and it was really because of the era of free agency. As the cost to play, to pay for these players increased, the Dodgers and then the Blue Jays and then the Braves and the Texas Rangers shifted their scouting focus to Latin America, to the Dominican Republic, because they can sign these players for cheap. One of those, again, storylines that's very fascinating is Omar Minaya was a scout at this point in time for the Texas Rangers, and he signed Sammy Sosa for $3,500 in 1987. And fast forward 15 years later, you see Minaya with the Mets and with the Expos prior to the Mets, and you see Sosa being this superstar of baseball. And in that trajectory, we also see the transition that's going on within baseball toward a more Latinized game, and with many issues that arise out of that. Even the steroids controversy is part of that, where the desire to make it into the major leagues, just to land that signing bonus, just to land that contract, oftentimes shapes the minds of these 14, 15-year-old kids to take something that a Buscón or someone else is encouraging them to do so they can get that $500,000 signing bonus. So really the story, I think, of baseball really in the late 20th century, early 21st century, is captured by the Dominicans and their players' rise to prominence in baseball, but how they do it as well.
Welcome your calls and questions. The program is Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert, and you can reach Adrian Burgos or Dave McMahon, a producer and writer of the show, as well as a consultant on the program, 333-9455 in the 217 area code, or 800-222-9455. We also have an email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Dave, Adrian just brought up the steroid scandal. I really like the way the program opens. We see one of these, one of the most dramatic moments in postseason history. I believe it was, 92 with the Braves and getting by the Pirates, this pinch hitter that I can't recall his name at the moment.
Cabrera.
Atlanta,
Cabrera.
Yeah, Cabrera gets this pinch single off the Pirates closer, and Who makes the throw to left field to try to nail Sid Bream? But Barry Bonds, and that was the last play he would make as a member of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing because the Pirates seemed to go into decline at that point, and they're over the next 15 years, I think they have failed to reach 500, and they're the sort of best example of the have-nots and not being able to sign a player like Barry Bonds, who eventually would go home to San Francisco and sign the biggest free agent contract in the history of the game in 1993. But Barry seemed to be the logical point to start with here. He eventually goes on to eclipse both Mark McGwire's record for single-season home runs and then Hank Aaron's record, one of the most hallowed records of all. And he made a decision, a rather tragic decision, I think, in 1998 to turn to steroids and help his cause. It's tragic because he had so many tools and was one of the premier players in the game without using steroids and would end up on baseball's Mount Rushmore without question. And he was focused on getting to 400 home runs and to 400 stolen bases and to being the best all-around player that he could be. And in 1988, as he was approaching this, he was completely eclipsed by Sosa and McGwire, who had captured everyone's imagination with their pursuit of Maris' record. And that seemed to really, from what we could tell, hurt his feelings. And so he makes this almost devil's bargain to turn to steroids, and then we watch some of the most incredibly played baseball we have ever seen.
Yeah, it's funny how you track the career, rise and fall of Bonds, because there's a section on there where he's on this ridiculous torrid home run pace in 2001, and as I'm watching this again last night, I'm hearing the date. You know, we're in early days of September of 01, and everything stops because of the 9/11 tragedies.
That's right. And then after he picks up where he left off after that. And many, I think it was the Kansas City Star that said, you know, we thank God for Bonds. I mean, he's giving us something uplifting here in such troubled times. But it's, you know, the commentator, I think Gary Honig, refers to the classics. And then there's Tom Boswell, who turns to Shakespeare to try to give us a sense of the scale of this tragedy, that just comparing him to other ballplayers doesn't seem to work. And so I think that his story really captured our imagination, but we sort of felt like in this era we're so quick to rush to judgment, and that we wanted to put forward the sort of entire Bond story and see it from 360 degrees. And so we actually go back from 1992 and that almost moment where he misses throwing out Sid Bream at home plate, and go all the way back to his childhood and introduce his father, who was a great all-around player in his own right, and played alongside the great Willie Mays. And those two players were so influential, Barry's father, they were so influential in shaping his sense of what Major League Baseball was. And I think what he learned from them was, you know, this game is not going to take care of you. It's not going to protect you. So you have to look out for number one. And I think he carried a lot of that into his playing days. And so a lot of people described him as surly. And I think as he approached the record, the way that he handled the press, the word out on the street about how he was about other players, it led us to judge him quickly. And I think we wanted to step back and take a more sort of a high angle view of this and see the whole thing.
Yeah, we really did get a whole sense of his character, and who would have thought back, you know, in 01 or in his heyday, in his big days with the Pirates, when he just couldn't deliver when the postseason rolled around, that he would be so ostracized or so, you know, looked frowned upon by now. But when we talk about steroids now, though, the name that comes up more recently after the show was produced is Roger Clemens and being indicted and the prospect of him serving some prison time, maybe a year or so.
Yes, we do tell some of the Clemens story, not quite as much as, you know, the Bond story sort of follows the entire arc of our story. But I think actually, as an aside from the film, that Clemens gives us an interesting case of one option, how you could handle being accused of this and that you could deny it. And, you know, he chose to brush back Congress like he would a hitter with his high heat. Or you could go the route, say, of Andy Pettit, who was contrite and who gave an explanation for it and promised that it was simply that he wanted to get back on the field and help the team. And if you go that route, we seem to be a forgiving culture, and we want to invite them back in and embrace them. And if you do what Clemens did, we read it as arrogance, and I don't think people believe him. But again, Bonds was sort of the most significant figure, I think, of this stretch for us. And so the Clemens, in the end, we sort of wrap it up and we explain where all of these main characters of this steroids drama stand at the end. And it's Bonds, I think, who is the most central for us.
Well, and the central part of most any, I think, many sports documentaries is Bob Costas, and he pointed out here how so many fans and I guess journalists, certainly the union officials, were turning a blind eye for a year when all these inflated stats were coming up from players And for so long, baseball, you know, Players Association, they refused to implement any kind of drug testing policy. And I believe Don Fehr, you know, pressure was put on him for some time to try and implement this.
Well, I don't think it was a conspiracy hatched by the union. I think that everybody is to blame for this. I mean, you know, the attendance was down after the 1994 strike, and in 1996, home run totals skyrocketed, and there were new parks that were built. They had smaller fences. As we know now, the players had turned to drugs. People were filling the seats, and I think the owners were excited about this. They had the game had fallen on hard times, and now everybody was rushing back. And, you know, Don Fehr and the union, and before him, what was the union chief, the great Adrian, what was the name of the
Marvin Miller.
Marvin Miller, of course. So Marvin Miller had brought in free agency in 1975, and before that, the players had basically been enslaved. Those players who were allowed to play Major League Baseball had been enslaved by the owners, and so between 1975 and 1994, what you get is warfare between the two parties. I think there are a collective bargaining agreement is negotiated on 8 separate occasions, and each time there's a strike or a lockout or the thought of one. And so this had been going on forever. And so by 1994, I think it was just habit of the union to reject a lot of the positions of MLB. And for Donald Fehr, this is about principle. It's about standing on principle. We're not going to allow drug testers to walk into our players' homes on Christmas morning and demand that they pee into a cup. And in hindsight, for someone like Bob Costas, that seemed like a horrible position for them to take. But I would say that I don't think journalists did their part. And there it was. The story was right in front of them, and they didn't see it or they didn't want to report on it. They didn't come to Steve Wilstein's aid when he found the bottle of Andro in Mark McGuire's locker. And for our part, we continued to go to the ball games in droves. So I think we were enjoying it.
Well, and you made reference early about the McGuire-Sosa home run race of 98. Ironic that something that was at least partially influenced by steroids, because Mark McGuire has been, well, it's been forthcoming, and Sosa's name has been linked to some of this, that this is what we can credit largely, or at least to some part, of bringing fans back. Something that is now apparently tied to some of this scandal.
That 1998 season was such both reviving the interest in the game and also captured part of the contradictions of what's going on, where you have, I like to call it the summer of baseball love. And you have Sosa, the foreigner, who actually injects the love of baseball, the joy of baseball back into the game. He, in a certain sense, transforms McGuire into someone who was very quiet, someone who did not really express the sheer joy of being a ball player. And really, with those press conferences and Sosa using Chico Escuela's old name, baseball or old line, baseball has been very, very good to me. Yet part of that and storyline there, I think, captures the Latino storyline once again, in that the Bay Area, Jose Canseco, really being that figure who really starts interjecting the whole steroids into the game and was a symbol of its success and its human frailty. And as Dave was mentioning, one of the really powerful contradictions that goes on is when Steve Wilstein finds DeAndro, Wilstein's vilified, and the questions are not asked about, what exactly is going on, when, as it's pointed out in the documentary, Randy Barnes just days earlier gets banned from the Olympics for life and the U.S. track and field for life for using Andro. And in baseball, it was like, Wilstein's the bad guy. Don't ask questions. And on that point, what we see is, as Howard Bryant says, the baseball machine basically swallows up Wilstein and spits him out. And it's, let's try to, because baseball is this distraction in 98, and it becomes a distraction in 2001, a way to help us, begin to move in a healing way from 9/11. And so that's part of the power of the game and its history. And yet it illuminates the choices and at times the tragic choices. I really appreciate one of the new voices that is brought into this is Marcos Breton, who's a Mexican-American from the Bay Area, and he speaks to the Latino experience. But another thing is the Latino sports writer who's bilingual, who can talk to a Sammy Sosa, to a Miguel Tejada in Spanish, interview him in that language. And it was, again, a wonderful thing to see that the 10th inning has that kind of a voice involved, because it captures the transition that's going on in baseball from the mid-20th century into the late 20th century, a transition that we don't necessarily see widespread within the press corps.
Well, since we're talking a bit about Marcos Breton, and we had talked about some of this recently, Adrian. In fact, there's an interview that a web-based interview that you and I did at Illinois Field that if you go to our homepage, will.illinois.edu, you can go to the baseball site and watch that. One of the more emotional moments in 10th inning is talking about Roberto Clemente and sharing, spreading his love in Spanish to his parents back home. And Breton is so emotional discussing a ball player in, you know, in the early 70s speaking in Spanish to a national audience?
For me, it's one of the two really powerful baseball moments that gives me chills when I think back on it as a historian of the Negro Leagues, of the Latino experience in baseball. Clemente takes his grandest moment in the game to take that stage and command it to recognize his Latino-ness and to ask the blessing in Spanish of his parents and to also give his blessing to his own children. They just won the World Series. This is the pinnacle of his career. A similar moment occurs in 67 when Ted Williams, who many people don't know, his mother was born in Mexico. He's partly of Mexican extraction then. Uses his Hall of Fame induction moment to talk about the Baseball Hall of Fame needs to recognize the great Negro League players and that they should be in the Hall of Fame. Those kinds of moments where players really go beyond themselves as moments of personal aggrandizement and to speak to the culture, to speak to the history, are just, as a historian, it just moves me in ways. And I think that's what really captured Marcos Breton in that moment when he recalls seeing an Afro-Puerto Rican speaking in Spanish. Finally, there's a moment on this grand stage of baseball where a Latino feels home. He sees home being represented to the broad American public.
But as you and I had talked about a few weeks ago in our web interview, there are some obstacles still to overcome. The Cuban defector from on the Yankees, El Duque, Orlando Hernandez. He had his own translator in the dugout, and then Yankees did not want to pay for that person anymore.
In many ways, what we continue to see in the story of Latinos in baseball is the story of Latinos in American society. This is what much of my research aims to look at. And what the story was with El Duque Hernandez, after he had been with the Yankees for 5-6 years, enjoyed World Series success, the team told him, you're using your translator as a crutch. So we're not going to credential your translator. We're not going to pay for him. And El Duque says, I'll pay for him. And ultimately, what the Yankees told him was that, you know, we expect you to assimilate, to learn the English language by now. It's an expectation that is different of Latino players than it is of Asian players. And this is what Ozzie Guillen was getting at recently in his comments about how differently Asian players who are coming in as, yes, they're seasoned veterans for the most part, but El Duque was a seasoned veteran. Many of the Cubans who come in, like Jose Contreras, are coming in as seasoned veterans, and they are also treated much like the 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-old Dominican or Venezuelan who are being signed in terms of the expectation after a few years is you will assimilate to U.S. culture, learn English, speak to the press in English. And it really captures how Latinos are in a particularly unique space when it comes to the U.S. professional baseball. They're expected to be much like the U.S. Immigrant to the United States society. And that's a very powerful story as well.
And well, I'd just like to add to that, that if it doesn't work out and they don't become the next Sammy Sosa after traveling as teenagers up here without being fully armed with the language capacity, that they could end up choosing not to go back to work in the cane fields, but instead to come to New York City and be undocumented and try to find work in either an above or below ground profession of some sort. And so it seems to be this tricky thing where it could lead to making a lot of money or could lead to having uprooted you from your home life and landing you in a place which is not a natural situation for you.
We're talking with U of I history professor Adrian Burgos and 10th Inning writer and producer Dave McMahon. We'll welcome your calls about if there's any themes associated with baseball today, or maybe you've watched some of the previews in the program premiering tomorrow night on PBS. It'll be on tomorrow night and Wednesday evening, Ken Burns' new program, The 10th Inning. Welcome your calls and questions at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. I don't know how much you can talk about this, Dave, but were there a lot of people or some that turned you away and said, I don't want to be part of a PBS documentary, or maybe I don't want to discuss the steroid scandal, it's too embarrassing? Or...
Well, we made an attempt to get Barry Bonds to commit to an interview, and this went on for some months He did consider it. He took a look at the original series, but in the end decided that he didn't want to appear in our program talking about his accomplishments, but then not addressing the steroids, which he said he would not do. But I think in the end, we were able to find, through our archival research, some bits and pieces from various press conferences that he gave, and what you get instead of a sort of canned interview where he's not addressing these the critical topics is a candid, sometimes angry response from Barry, where he does articulate his feelings about it. And so I think it does help create a full portrait of who he was and what was on his mind at the time. So we don't feel we would love to have spoken to him. We don't feel like the film suffers for it.
I got a caller on line four from Belgium. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello and good morning to you all. I have not caught every moment of your program today, and I hope I'm not going through old ground. But over here in the Danville area, we have an individual who was a member of the Negro League. His name is Bobo Smalls, an excellent gentleman, comes to schools and is always talking very positive things to school children. He's done it for many, many, many years, and I just wanted to give him some accolades. But I also wanted to bring up the topic. Also in Danville here, we happen to have a very old historic ballpark, one of the old style back in the 40s, 30s. I'm not exactly sure when it was built, but it's all wood with bleachers. And they made a movie here, The Babe, because it looks so much like the old time. And we have minor league teams here that, when I say minor, I mean very minor. They're not AAA or anything like that, but they're college players that, who come in and play here and then move on into the rest of their lives, where they go on to big leagues or what, you know. And I was wondering, how does that play into your show? Do you even talk about the minor leagues and these small parks? Because there's a lot of very nice ones all over the United States that do fairly well. Even when the strike was going on, I think they were doing ball playing too. Would you like to approach that?
We crammed about as much as we could into the 4 hours that we thought was appropriate for this subject, and so we didn't have an opportunity to address the current state of the minor leagues. I guess it, the only way it does actually come up is that before Bud Selig was able to get the MLB PA, the Players Association, to agree to testing, or they were able to agree together on testing, that he was able to implement it on the minor league level. And so what you do get as the testing takes hold is a group of ball players who have come up from the minor leagues and who are accustomed to being tested. But beyond that, it's not mentioned, and it's a shame because it would be interesting to study life down on the farm. And I guess it does also come up slightly when Pedro Martinez addresses coming north, having to move to, or I guess it's Omar Vizquel, having to move to a town like Butte, Montana, when you thought you were headed to New York City or Chicago, and trying to assimilate and figure out how to order breakfast and how to get along with a bunch of guys who don't speak the same language when you're missing home and you're 17 years old and this is a totally fresh and new and overwhelming, I'm sure, experience. So it does come up in that capacity.
And I also would like to point out that some of the very best baseball you can watch is in these small places, because these players are truly trying to become ball players, and they play with their whole heart. They don't worry about their salaries. They don't worry about this and that and everything else. They're playing the game to be playing the game. Thank you very much, sirs.
Thanks for the call. I did want to mention on the tail end of what you just said, there will be two segments on area baseball on WILL-TV to coincide with 10th inning. Tomorrow night there will be a segment just before 9 o'clock on Eastern Illinois League baseball, amateur baseball around this area. That'll be, I think, at 8:59, or just watch 10th inning. It'll be right after that. And closer to what the caller just mentioned, Wednesday night there'll be a segment on the Danville Dans, the Collegiate League team, playing there in Danville, again, right after 10th inning airs, just after 9 o'clock. So thanks for the call. We've got a call, another caller on the line, on line one. Champagne, go ahead.
Hi, and I also just tuned in. So I don't know if you've been talking about this, but I assume because you're covering the steroids era and everything, and because it so permeates baseball, you're talking about deception in baseball and trying to get an advantage either in the game, during the game, by cheating. The Derek Jeter thing, is that cheating that he pretended to be hit? I don't think so. And There was actually a catcher in the 19th century with the Cubs. He'd come from, I think, Boston. And he holds all kinds of records for stealing bases because the umpire was looking the other way, and he would cut bases off. And so I just wondered how you treat steroids versus deception on the field and just out-and-out lying on the field.
That's a great question. We begin our discussion of steroids with a kind of brief recap of, a history of cheating, but the fact that cheating has long been a part of the game. In some cases, it's condoned. We're allowed to steal second base. And what Keith Oberman says to begin our sort of chapter on this is that some aspects of cheating are weirdly commendable if you can get away with it. But I think we all have a sense that something is lost when we alter the chemistry of our bodies to be able to get an advantage. But I think that one could say that it was an accurate reflection of what was going on in larger society. I mean, we're a pharmacologically driven culture where we turn to pills to help our kids focus in school, and we turn to pills to do better in the bedroom. And so it's really not a surprise that our athletes were willing to turn to chemicals to help get an advantage as well.
So you talk about the scampish deception where, you know, they had to bring in more umpires to watch the guys so they're not going straight from first to third or whatever, and pretending to be hit and whatever. It happens all the time. And so that we enjoy about the game. And we even enjoy it when Greg Maddux's brother used to use sandpaper, you know, on the ball. So that's different. And do you talk about that?
Yes. Well, we do. Gaylord Perry, in his example, and you know, how often did he actually load up the baseball with gunk or file it down, and how often did he just do something with his hands to make you think that he was doing it? And so in some ways we admire that degree of deception, but I think that there's something, you know, about the authenticity of it or the integrity of it that is lost when you have guys secretly loading up on steroids in the bathroom stall. And I think the tricky part about that is then you force players to make a decision. Do I use and stay in the game, and is that going to compromise my own sense of fairness? Or do I not use and run the risk of getting run out of the game because the guy next to me is going to use? And so that's a decision that I don't think we want to leave in the hands of our athletes. But I think that you're right. We do have a kind of fascination and appreciation for a guy who's willing with deception to do something a little extra to help the team win. Just there is a line, and we're figuring it out, I think, these days exactly what's acceptable.
Thanks for the call. We are talking for about another 13 minutes or so about 10th inning. Ken Burns' follow-up to baseball. It will be on the next two nights, a four-hour program on PBS stations. And we're talking with Dave McMahon, a writer and co-producer, as well as history professor here at the University of Illinois, Adrian Burgos, who is a consultant advisor on Latino baseball. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. One thing we haven't really talked about is teams and the dominance of teams. Another thing that has happened since the production of 10th inning, pretty significant passing. George Steinbrenner died on July 13th, and we're talking about a guy who is so committed to winning and will bring in the top names and spend the money. And it's hard to imagine the way the Yankees have dominated in recent years, a Yankee team with a losing record in the season.
Adrian, as a Yankees fan, would you like to address that?
Well, you know, one of the things we do see is that this era of free agency becomes even more absurd in the late 20th century as Steinbrenner begins to expend incredible amounts of capital in signing these players. But the other side of that as well is the combination of bringing in players out of the Caribbean. So we see the rise in Latin America. We see the rise of Mariano Rivera. Jorge Posada's a Puerto Rican. We see Robinson Cano. And so what Steinbrenner, in a certain sense, masters is, flood the market with this capital, acquire the best players. But a couple of the key figures, and this is part of why the Yankees are able to become dominant in the late 20th and early 21st century, was combining that with actually producing some players out of their own system for once, which was the failure that they had experienced during the 1980s. The other part of it that to me is really interesting is that strike of 1994 does not fundamentally address what was wrong with the economics of the game. And what they actually permit to happen was the Yankees of the late 20th and early 21st century, because spending the way, a bunch of drunken sailors might be the analogy at port. This is what owners do. And again, Sabathia's contract and Teixeira's contract. But it wasn't just the Yankees. It's the other part of the story. Tom Hicks' ridiculous contract to Alex Rodriguez with the Texas Rangers, which, again, fundamentally altered the stakes and, in a certain sense, pushed other teams to go even deeper into Latin America, into the Dominican Republic, and into Venezuela. So Steinbrenner really altered the stakes of what was going on. But that 94 strike, which is told and recaptured in the 10th inning, becomes once again a compelling moment to think about what could have been if it had been done or bargained in fairness.
We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I would like to draw a line, a relationship between, say, the steroid use and some of the more mundane rules of the game. For example, the fluid strike zone, where, every time you watch a ball game, the announcer says, well, we're going, the umpire strike zone is this or that. And the players, as soon as they figure it out, that's fine, even though a ball might be, say, 3 inches outside, it's still a strike and they don't complain about it. The neighborhood play at second base, where, of course, they don't really touch the second baseman doesn't touch the base when he has the ball. A throw into, where a tag play where the runner obviously gets to the base before he's tagged, even though the ball beat him. And so those, all of those plays are accepted without any argument, and yet there are some things like, hey, steroids, now there's a hard and fast rule. Or they really get technical about whether they really get precise on whether a ball that hits the foul is fair or foul. It seems like, well, we're going to have some rules that would just sort of adapt to, would just sort of change day to day, and others that I know, of course, steroids is a lot more significant, but seems like if they're going to take, say, a holier-than-thou sort of approach, it ought to be consistent. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, maybe I'll address their first point about the strike zone, which I think is an interesting thing, and I think we have seen this sense in recent years. You'll find an umpire saying something like, well, I called my strike zone, as if their strike zone was a work of art that was exclusively theirs and someone else had a different one. And so that does become kind of tricky, and maybe along with that is the kind of arrogance that, the umpires have a role to play beyond just fairly calling balls and strikes and outs. And so that's a shame, but I think we have this great moment at the beginning of this year where Armando Galarraga is on his way to a perfect game, and he gets a ground ball that should be the final out, and Jim Joyce, the umpire, calls the runner safe at first base, and a replay clearly reviews that he was out. And then you get 2 days of discussion about this, and we see some of the most heroic behavior from Joyce and then from Galarraga as he forgives him. And Joyce says, I screwed this up. And we love those moments because they reveal that we're flawed, and we love when people can speak to their own flaws, and we want to forgive them, and we want to embrace them for it. And so one of the great things about the game is that it can show you know, the better parts of the human character and give us this, a peek at the humanity of some of these people. And so, yeah, it's not a perfect thing, but maybe we don't want it to be perfect because these are great teaching moments to tell us about ourselves.
The the call you talk about the perfect game, I agree with that. It's too bad they couldn't use replay. But I'd like to make this comment about that. That umpire, he was wrong. He was wrong. He admits he's wrong. But at the moment, he did something heroic. He says, well, I know if I fake, a guy's safe. But if I call him out, nobody's going to complain. It's going to be a perfect game. But he says, I think he's safe. I'm going to call him safe. So he made a mistake, but it was, as silly as this might seem, a heroic mistake. You see what I mean?
I couldn't agree more.
Pardon me?
I couldn't agree more.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Yeah, ironic, I think, that maybe that the near no-hitter, or it would have been if he hadn't, you know, botched the call, may be remembered more than the no-hitters that actually occurred this year, and we've had several lately.
Absolutely. I think if we were getting underway with an 11th inning today, that we would not be talking about one of the three or four other no-hitters when we kicked it off with a prologue, but instead we'd be talking about this great moment where he admitted his mistake. And then beyond that, Armando Galarraga was so gracious in saying, you know, he didn't say that man ruined what would have been the greatest moment of my life. He said, you know, all is forgiven. It happens. And so, you know, what a great thing to be able to, you know, to show your kids, this is sportsmanship right here. This is a classy guy, and this is how you should behave when you make a mistake or someone makes a mistake that costs you something and that they apologize for it.
Yeah, the accountability of Joyce in that moment was great. And I think one of the tensions that really arises out of the late 20th century and the early 21st century is the whole use of technology and use of steroids and performance enhancers and the lack of accountability and the lack of individuals being forthright about their role. And that even extends beyond the players to the owners. One of the dimensions that perhaps that 11th inning might cover is the sheer numbers of stadiums that are built during this era of performance enhancement. And, you know, even more recently when the Florida Marlins owner was hiding the profits that he was making, at the time they're pushing a public initiative to fund a brand new stadium. And he's pleading that we are not making money. And yet we see this boondoggle take place. And it's that tension between technology, regulation, and the ability of the game to allow for these human flaws to be revealed. You know, that's part of why I love the game.
Yeah, I think you're well on your way to a theme for 11th inning. So when does production start on the next chapter in this? Not being serious here, but there's always an opportunity for follow-up.
Maybe when the Red Sox win the World Series again, I don't know.
We talked a little bit about Steinbrenner and the Yankees, and that's one of the other things you cover is Boston finally breaking through and ending, if you want to call it, a curse.
We do. We cover it in depth, and unlike with the Yankee story, which is told from the perspective of Joe Torre and does mention George Steinbrenner, and then we meet this incredible cast of players who led this team in 1996, a cast that included Rivera and Jeter and Posada and Pettit, all guys that had come up through the Yankee system who Steinbrenner did not train away but let develop in part because of Gene Michaels suspecting they were all going to be great. Our story about the Red Sox actually focuses on the fans, is told from their perspective, and we get this story from, as I mentioned before, Doris Kearns Goodwin, but we also bring in Mike Barnicle, who is really the emotional center of this, and he makes it a multi-generational story, and through him we understand what it was like for a New Englander who had pined for this for so long to finally experience the bliss associated with the Red Sox winning the World Series, and as Tom Verducci says so eloquently in there, that he had never seen a championship affect a region the way that it had. The Red Sox winning the World Series captured the hearts of New England. And I think that if you were to check the phone records in New England from the moments after they won, that there would never have been a period where, maybe except for September 11th, where the phones rang as much as they did after the Sox won the World Series.
And you mentioned, of course, you had to show the Bartman play, the tragic end to the Cubs postseason run in 2003.
We do, and I think, you know, the baseball is so much about loss, and it's also about how you deal with it after. And so I think there's nothing more heartwarming in the film than when Steve Bartman says, "I am so deeply sorry from the bottom of this Cubs fan's broken heart." And you see him wiping a little bit of beer off of his brow, and your heart goes out to him. And then what we hear shortly after that is, "I'm angry at the guy," said Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. And that always breaks up the room. And so that's what people end up focusing on, is that the scandal that surrounded him, he ended up showing a little bit of that character in response to this mishap. Any of us would have done that. That ball is coming right down, and suddenly we forget where we are and what's happening in front of us, and we just want to protect ourselves or bring that souvenir home to the family. And so it's interesting how it plays out.
Yeah, never mind that the shortstop booted a ground ball a few minutes later. No, you know, fans failed to forget that. There were other factors there. We've got to wrap this up. 10th inning, the 10th inning. Ken Burns' program is on the next two evenings on WILL-TV and many other PBS stations at 7 p.m. and follow-up segments, localized segments on WILL around 9 o'clock on the Eastern Illinois League and Danville Dans on Tuesday and Wednesday evening. Our guests on Focus today have been Dave McMahon, a writer and co-producer of 10th Inning, and thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it, Dave.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
And Adrian Burgos, U of I history professor and advisor to Mr. Burns on 10th Inning. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.